What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Well, the House passed legislation to avert a strike of railroad workers. And can I just say this to start? Democrats suck at messaging. This is a major screw up in my view of epic proportions. This is one of those moments where, you know, Joe Biden, the most pro-labor president in the history of the country, in my view, and I still think he is, I think messaging-wise handled this poorly. Now, the House has done what the president asked. They have passed legislation to avert a nationwide strike. These workers cannot, as a matter of law, go on strike. And that has everything to do with our screwed up labor laws. The fact that the Railway Labor Act takes their right to strike away. We have seen this in the past. The last time a strike was crushed like this, or the potential of a strike, was back during the George H.W. Bush years, when H.W. Bush back then said, no, we're not going to allow you to strike. And the workers took it on the chin. Look, every time, this is where the frustration is. And look, I felt the frustration all day today as union members are expressing their dismay, their anger, their frustration, because this is another one of those moments where it appears from the outside, and this is all into the messaging, it appears from the outside that Biden has sided with big corporations, has sided with the rail barons, and that these workers are getting screwed. And the reality is, on this front, the fact that they don't have sick days, that is a screw job. Now, the message out of this was simple, I believe. And I think Bernie Sanders and others are saying, look, you know, we need sick days. I think the message out of this is every worker should have sick days. Everyone. This should be a rallying cry for a movement of people to say, you know what? They're right. Every worker should have time off to spend with their family. Every worker should have the opportunity to see their kids, especially when they're sick. Now, the legislation that was passed today, the one mandating that workers do not strike and forcing them to accept this contract as is, passed 290 to 137. I believe 8 Democrats voted against that bill, 129 Republicans. Again, the messaging in that Republicans voted for workers. That's the message the right is going to play. 129 Republicans stood up for working people. When the reality is this was what Republicans were always going to do. It's just now opportunism. Now, there was a second piece of legislation that was passed to partner with this that would have ensured 7 paid sick days for rail employees. Now, this is what should have happened. Biden should have said, get me a bill that gives them the 4 sick days that they want, and I will sign it tomorrow, and we will be done with this, and the workers will get what they want, the employer will get what they want, and we will move forward. No economic catastrophe, no end of the world, no falling sky, none of that. Simple. Now, that vote was 221 to 207, basically along party lines. But again, Democrats suck at messaging. So the messaging tomorrow is going to be Republicans stood up for working people. And the reality is, as I said, the simple way to avert a strike, give the workers the sick time that they earn. This is the reality of the moment. Give them what they've earned. When I tell you how much profit these rail barons have pocketed, it's going to be staggering. Last year alone, they pocketed profit. This is not operating ratio. This is profit. This is money in the pocket. $23 billion last year. In the first 3 quarters of this year, they're at $21.2 billion profit. They have never been more, well, maybe back in the 1880s, they were more profitable. And you wonder why inflation is through the roof. You wonder why families are struggling. But no, this is all the workers' fault. If the workers went on strike, it was going to be a catastrophe. It was going to be the end of the world. They're asking for 4 sick days. That's it. That's all. And by asking for that, what has corporate America done? Well, run to Congress to force this bill, this contract down these workers' throats. Without, of course, any sick time. And it's not even, this is the weird part. It's not even like you go, it has to be paid. They just want time off. They just want time to spend with their families. Now, what has corporate America done? They've scared the you-know-what out of everybody. You know, if these workers go on strike and they demand those sick days, it's the end of the economy. And understand, when this game of chicken is played, corporate America knows that they hold all the cards. Because, well, you know, as much as Biden is a pro-labor president, he's not going to allow 750,000 workers to be off the job. He's not going to allow our supply chain, which is still struggling to catch up, to come to a screeching halt. It's not going to happen. And I said this months ago. There's not going to be a strike because they won't allow it. But here's the problem I have. If you're not going to allow a strike to happen, then you've got to make sure that there is sick time to people. You got to make sure that they get what they need. Now, the other part of this I love that corporate America is saying, well, you know, we can't shut things down because we can't give them this stuff because they're essential. We need them. They're essential workers. If they were to go on strike, they would be this cataclysmic failure of epic proportions. It'd be the sky would fall. So the serious question that pops into my mind, if these workers are so damn important, then why don't you give them sick time? Why don't you give them time off when they're sick to be well, to be mentally in the right space, if they're that important? And it's not like the railroad companies are complaining that they can't afford it. No, they're not complaining about that at all. They know they can afford it. They just don't want to. It was pointed out that seven sick days, now they want 4. It was pointed out that 7 sick days would cost the railroad industry about $321 million. 15 paid days a year would cost about $688 million a year. Now remember what I told you a minute ago. Last year they made $23 billion worth of profit. This year, 21.2 in the first 3 quarters, and that's $1 billion. It would only cost $688 million to get to 15. Again, they're asking for 4. Warren Buffett, who owns BNSF, one of the nation's largest railroad companies, just last week had a day where his net worth went up $1.4 billion. One day. That's enough to pay for paid sick day, 15 days, what, paid sick days for a week, for what, 4 years? Just one day. That's all. Now, the thing that bothers me is if we were, I don't know, a country that valued workers, if we were a country, that had sane, rational labor laws, that cared about family values, away, because Republicans tell us how much they're the party of family values, where is their legislation to go, no, every worker should have paid time to get well, to heal, to spend time with family? Where are our family values, people? Because here's where the uprising should come. The uprising shouldn't be against Joe Biden, because that's where all of the attention is right now. How could Biden do this? How could the Democrats do this? They weren't going to allow the economy to collapse. They weren't going to take that. Republicans would be thrilled if that were to happen. But this is the moment where we've got to turn the frame a little bit. And the frame being turned is we should be pushing legislation to ensure that every working person use this as the poster child, if you will, because the railroad workers aren't the only ones who don't get paid time off. Every worker should have paid time off. Every worker should have time to spend with their family. But these guys, these women, these railroad engineers, on call 24/7, 365, at the behest of corporate America, always waiting for the phone to ring, always waiting. This is, I'll tell you, it's crazy. And this is why I keep coming back to, we need politicians who are going to stand up against corporate America. We need politicians who are going to stand up to fight for labor law reform. We need politicians who are going to make sure that working families get a fair shake. And that's why I'm in Georgia, fighting to get Raphael Warnock back in the Senate. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1854. That was the day that Mary McDowell, known as the Angel of the Chicago Stockyards, was born. Mary's father brought the family to Chicago from Cincinnati after the Civil War. Her family was friends with U.S. President Rutherford B. Hayes, and as a young woman, she spent a month in the White House as a guest. Mary received her college degree and worked as a teacher for a wealthy family in New York. But living and working among the wealthy was not to be the course of her life. She returned to Chicago and became a kindergarten teacher at the famed Hull House. She then became the head of the University of Chicago Settlement House in the back of the yards. The Settlement House served the diverse neighborhoods around the Chicago stockyards. The community center included a library, play lots, gymnasiums, and classrooms. Mary and her Settlement House supported the rights of workers to form unions and to have safe working conditions. In 1903, Mary became the head of the Illinois chapter of the National Women's Trade Union League. The Pittsburgh Press reported on an incident that captured the spirit of Mary McDowell. The city of Chicago had a practice of using garbage to fill holes in the streets surrounding the stockyards. Mary showed up at the mayor's office with a group of women from the neighborhood and demanded, quote, "All right, we want the rest of it dumped on Lakeshore Drive. If it's good enough for the stockyards, it's good enough for the drive too." As a result, the city stopped using garbage to repair the streets. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Why does this matter? The Democrats have already controlled the Senate. You go, no, you need that extra vote. We need, especially now more than ever, need that extra vote. And look, the reality is I think Raphael Warnock is a good man. I think he's a much better human being than Herschel Walker. So to me, this is almost a no-brainer. I mean, policy aside, I just look at Raphael Warnock as a decent human being.
And he is. He's a very decent human being. He's somebody that I've known personally for 15, 20 years as the pastor of Ebenezer, Dr. King's church. I knew him both at my time at the Atlanta Labor Council and now at the State Fed. And we were excited. It took a lot of people's voices to get him to run for office to start with. And I think Stacey Abrams probably deserves a lot of credit for getting him to run the first time. But once he got in there, he's proven that he supports working families. He's proven that he cares about the middle class and the working class folks. And, you know, he's led the way on a number of issues. And just starting with the healthcare issue of capping insulin at $35. He wrote that stuff and he drove that bill. So he stood with the labor movement on pensions and helped our pensions survive. So Senator Warnock's a good, decent man, a good friend, and we're excited and happy to be working very hard for him. And we are working very hard here in Georgia.
No, I've been talking to union members, you know, across the state, and the story that I get is there's a sense of excitement that this guy is going to carry their message and their hopes and their dreams and their wants into the Senate that he understands. And this is, for me, this is one of those important candidates who I think truly does get it. So when we're out talking to union members, and I've been spending the last couple of days here in Georgia doing that, you know, being able to say, yeah, he did exactly what you said. He helped save multi-employer pension funds, of which all of these folks, you know, were keenly aware. He's going to help, I hope, in the future, ensure that workers have the right to organize, have an ability to organize, streamline a process to get people to be able to join in form unions by passing something like the PRO Act. There's so much here that so much fertile ground for working people to hold on to, I think.
Absolutely. And you said it, Rick, just a few minutes ago. The difference is crystal clear. Herschel Walker, he was a hell of a football player. One of the greatest football players I've ever seen in college. And
yeah.
I was in my 20s when he was starring at the University of Georgia. And, you know, he can play football. But, you know, unfortunately, he's got a history and a past. And it's not very good. You know, he's quite honestly, he's threatened wives. He's beaten wives. He lies all the time. He's just not qualified to be a U.S. senator. And, you know, and I think that's going to bear out on December 6th. Yeah, I really.
No, I'm with you. But here's the thing. And this is where, you know, all of the bad things aside, you know, and then look, he's done horrible things. I saw one woman with a sign that says, do I have to be Herschel Walker's girlfriend to get an abortion, since there's so much of that in his past? My problem also is the policies that he doesn't have. We've heard all about these werewolves and, you know, all kinds of weird, bizarre stories of being an FBI agent, but we haven't heard about what he wants to do, especially for working people. Now, I got to assume he's going to fall into line with Mitch McConnell and the other Republicans, who I've been saying for the longest time hate working people. I got to assume he's just going to be a rubber stamp vote for McConnell and whatever the Republican leadership wants.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the only reason they're holding their noses and are supporting him is the fact that they know he will be a solid vote. But let's be clear. He doesn't support our right to organize. He doesn't support raising the minimum wage or people making a livable wage. He doesn't care whether or not workers have health care. Everything we stand for, he really doesn't care. And yeah. It's clear he said it. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think that's what's going to get him.
No, I sure hope so. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Charlie Fleming. Charlie is the president of the Georgia AFL-CIO. We'll get links out on social media how you can check a look at their website. But here's the thing, Charlie, and this is where, you know, just the big news right now is the president came out and, you know, sadly, again, you know, I'm not going to beat up on the president for coming out on this rail situation. For me, this whole situation hinges on the fact that we've got such bad labor law, that the Railway Labor Act is such a bad piece of legislation that is not favorable to working people. It's written for the railroad barons, For me, someone like Warnock in the Senate, I want to see him put forth a piece of legislation to undo this, to make sure that workers have rights and that Congress can't come in and just, you know, impose something on them. I'm curious your thoughts on this whole situation, but more importantly, the fact that we need major comprehensive labor law reform.
Absolutely. Well, I would on this situation, on the rail situation, I'm not very that close to it. I mean, I do know that there's been a number of unions that supported the agreement. I guess there's, what, three that have said, no, we're not. But from what I understand, there's a lot of good things in that bill, in that contract. But there's also some things that obviously three of the unions said, no, we're just not going to do it. And but I will say this. I came up through the Railroad Labor Act. I spent 35 years in the airline industry. So there was times when we pushed to try to get that act changed. But you have to be careful because sometimes you there's some things of that act that will help you in situations and negotiations with companies. They won't be able to just enact some things.
Okay. Help me with that. Help me through that. What is positive about the RLA?
Well, I would say that the one of the biggest things is they just can't, one, they can't lock you out without going through the process. I mean, you have to go through, as long as the economy is going to be affected. Clinton stepped in on some airline, I'm trying to forget which airline it was, but he stepped in and when was either United or American that was going to go out back in the when he was in office, he stepped in and made them go back to the bargaining table. I just think that for the most part, yes, I totally agree that we need labor law reform. And the most of the parts of the Railroad Act is probably not positive, but it can cut both ways. And I just say that, it's cumbersome. It drags things out. But it probably does favor the companies more than because they know we will not be able to just walk out
right.
Because the government president will step in.
No, and this has been the learned behavior, which is why the railroad companies are going, no, this is what you're getting and you're not getting anything more. And because this is the part that gets me. I'm struggling with the fact that you have these workers who have no personal time. There's no sick time here. If you get sick, there's no time for you. If your kids get sick, there's no time for you. And I'm hoping that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats do move on something to ensure that in this contract there will be sick days. And maybe here's an even better idea. Maybe we make sure that every working person in this country gets sick days. Maybe this is that beginning of that conversation that says every working person should have that kind of security.
Absolutely. Everybody deserves to be able to take care of their families if they work full time. There's no doubt about that. And I actually had thought that there was some sick leave built into the new contract.
There wasn't, and that's why where we are. For these engineers, there's nothing. And the sad reality is, and we've talked to the unions who represent these people, they're on call 24/7, 365. Their lives are not their own. If they get sick, there's no making a doctor appointment. That's why these sick days were so vital. And I'm still hoping. I'm not going to beat the president up too much. But in this moment, I'm struggling because this is the reason I bring this up, Charlie, because, you know, our president is, in my view, still the most pro-union president that we've had in my lifetime, at least. The message now is, you know, in days before this runoff election is, well, now not so much. And the Republicans are jumping on this saying, you know, we're going to stand with these workers. And this for me is that moment for Democrats to stand up and say, no, we support these workers.
Well, I think all of our members need to do is think about 4 years ago when Trump said he was going to do all this stuff. The Republicans have made their bed. They have never supported workers, and they don't intend to support workers. They'll talk a good game like Trump did 4 years ago and then won't do a dang thing for workers. Yeah. And that's why Joe Biden has been seen the way he has, because he come in and he's done things to help workers.
Yeah. So last question I've got for you. What's the message from now to election day for everybody out there?
Well, we're just telling people to go vote. Early voting is up. We got had a record day yesterday here. Had over 300,000 people vote. First day of early voting, or actually the first day of the last week, because there was some that was done over the weekend. But the numbers are up. I just would encourage everybody to go vote. It's critically important who we have representing us in this state, and it certainly shouldn't be Herschel Walker.
There you go. Charlie Fleming, I appreciate the time. Get out there, knock on the doors, and keep up the great work.
Well, thank you again. We appreciate you having us on, and appreciate you helping educate our members. Thanks, Rick.
Good stuff. Charlie Fleming, president of the Georgia AFL-CIO. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break back here from Atlanta, Georgia. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, wow, have I been taking... It's weird, because I've been taking this beating over Biden's announcement that he wants Congress to act. And look, I've been defending him, and rightly so. Look, I think he's been doing the right things on infrastructure. I think he's been doing the right things on manufacturing. I think he's been doing a lot of the right stuff. This is a bad one. This is not good in my view, and which is why I've asked our good friend David Dayan to come talk with us, share some thoughts. He's the executive editor over at the American Prospect. Prospect.org is their website. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rick.
So I'm looking at this situation that we're in, and the sad reality is, like I said, I defended Biden. I'm all on board. I want to make sure that we get, the best deal we can get, that, workers don't get cheated. Biden's the most pro-labor president in the history of the country. Why this? Why did he have to come out now? Why did that have to happen?
Well, it's funny. I mean, you can hold two things in your head at the same time. He can still be the most pro-labor president in the history of the United States and do this to the rail workers, because there haven't been many pro-labor presidents in the United States in the past. The reason for the timing is that all of the rail unions, there are 12 of them, have now voted on this tentative agreement. I believe 4 out of the 12 have voted against it. That actually represents a majority of the workers, by the way, who are under the contract. And they have now, under the terms of the Railway Labor Act, they have until December 8th to strike or be locked out.
Right.
And we all know, I mean, we can all say this, that a strike would be debilitating. It'd be debilitating for working people, by the way, right?
Yes.
Because the supply chains would be completely cut off. People would have trouble getting medicine, getting food. It would be a real struggle. And Biden obviously didn't want to risk that at all, even though it's the only leverage that these unions who want a better contract have. And, of course, the seeds of this go back to what I mentioned just a second ago, which is the Railway Labor Act of 1926, which was put together sort of in the wake of the Pullman strike and some of these other things, to really give transportation employers the upper hand against transportation unions. Because under the terms of that, it really governs labor relations in the railroad industry, in the airline industry, and it prevents strikes. I mean, that's the biggest thing that it does. It prevents the ability for a strike to happen. It creates mediation as a preliminary step. After that, a presidential board that the president actually did put together back in the summer that puts sort of almost like a third party arbitrator that puts together an agreement. And if that all fails, the ability for Congress to enforce the terms of that PEB, that board agreement, that the president put together. This has been done before. It was done in 1991, I believe, right before a rail strike right then, and was signed by George H.W. Bush. And it looks like that's what's going to happen now. Congress has said that they're going to, you know, put forward this resolution, pass it, get it signed by the president, and force these rail workers who don't want this contract back on the job.
Yeah, but here's my problem. I come back to this. Did Biden have to come out and ask for this? I mean, this is one of those things. Why do you have to jump into the middle of this? Is this something that he had to do?
Or? I mean, you know, he didn't have to under the terms of the law. He didn't have to come out and say, I request that Congress pass this. The resolution was already out there. It was put together by two Republicans back in the summer.
Of course
it was.
They
were trying to force them back on the job. And my belief is that Congress would have passed this anyway. Whether Biden said, you know, give it to me or don't give it to me, they would have put it in his lap and said, sign this. So no, he didn't have to do that. I think the cleaner thing that you can say about Biden is he put together the presidential emergency board that ended up putting an agreement on the table that didn't include the main request of the workers, which is sick days.
Right.
And or included one sick day. Right. And that's the core of the problem. Now, if this was a friendlier agreement, we wouldn't be having this conversation. If it was a more of a fair agreement. But obviously, the rail worker unions that decided not to agree to this contract, and it was narrow, by the way. The smart TD, they I think it was like 52-48 or something like that. They voted down the contract. You know, they if a better agreement was on the table, they probably would have accepted it, and it wouldn't have even had to be, you know, just basic humanity. Allow someone who's sick to go to the hospital or to go to the doctor without threat of being fired.
Right.
I mean, that's really all that they were asking for.
Yeah, they weren't asking for weekends. I mean, they weren't asking for what everybody else in the workforce takes for granted. They weren't even asking for that, which is the really amazing part in this.
Absolutely. And so if you want to fault Biden, absolutely fault him for putting together a presidential emergency board that came back with that agreement. Once that agreement is on the table, under this really bad law that should be repealed, that treats transportation workers like no other workers in the economy, under this law, there's no way it's going to get to a strike. I mean, not legally anyway, right? I mean, maybe a wildcat or something, but there's no way legally that you're going to get to a strike because Congress will step in to prevent a supply chain disaster. And whether or not Biden had to say that or not, or request it, it was probably going to happen anyway.
No, it was going to happen anyway. My problem is I've always said that it's not going to go to a strike. And if it is, it's going to be a very short, you know, couple of minutes.
Right.
But that Congress would act. I'm struggling with Biden coming out and taking this position.
I don't disagree with you. Disagree with you, but I have a problem with Congress doing it too. Like you know, what other industry does Congress get to step in and say, no, you're not allowed to use the only power you have as a worker, which is the ability to collectively say, we are walking off this job if we don't get the terms that we need to continue. No other industry that has that position where Congress can step in and say, no, tough, you're going back to work. So I think that's the core of the problem.
Yeah.
And so if you look forward, there has to be some reforms here.
Yeah.
Now, the
question I have, David, is if Congress has this power that they can impose this contract, don't they have the power to change it? Couldn't they say, look, okay, we're going to make this contract better. Since you two parties can't come to an agreement, we're going to decide that. Yeah, they get a sick day. They get two sick days. Maybe they get a weekend every other month. Maybe is there nothing they could add to it?
I mean, that's what is interesting, is that you are starting to see some members of Congress come out and say, you know, if we're going to force them back on the job, we should force it back on the job with decent terms. And not just the usual suspects, not just Bernie Sanders, John Hickenlooper, the Democrat from Colorado, who's seen as pretty centrist, came out today and said, you know, we should give several sick days to these rail workers before we force them back on the job with this contract. So it remains to be seen. I assume that the leadership will want to push this through fast without any amendments. But, you know, whether there's enough support for the workers, you know, they need 60 votes in the Senate to get this done. So maybe there is a possibility here. In a larger sense, I think what needs to be done is more regulatory force upon these rail companies, because the only in given what we have with Railway Labor Act, the only kind of countervailing force on the rail companies is the Surface Transportation Board. That is the regulator, right? The national rail regulator. And Martin Obermann, who I had the opportunity to interview just a few weeks ago, he I think has been very aggressive in saying that for too long, rail companies have cut staff, cut capacity at the expense of commerce, at the expense of the workers, and just to make a buck. And he was very forthright about this to me. He was not messing around. He was not reading between the lines in any way. And so more work on the part of the STB to say, no, you have to staff these things properly. You can't put one person on a whole train. You have to, you know, have the capacity available so that you can get goods across.
Yeah.
You have to be regulated. I think that ultimately would end up being a better deal for these workers.
No, I mean, of course, that's the problem. These companies have gotten so large, they've consolidated to the point to where they're monopolistic, right? And they collude. I mean, you know, this is,
and you know, one thing we shouldn't forget here is that there is a proposed merger that has been on the books for a little while that has not been approved yet by the Surface Transportation Board. It's between Canadian Pacific and I believe it's either Norfolk Southern or Kansas City Southern. It's Kansas City Southern and Canadian Pacific. That would bring us from 7 Class I railroads to 6. There were 40 in the 1980s. There are now 6, and really there are 4 major ones, and 2 are in the east and 2 are in the west. So you have an effective duopoly across the country. And a lot of times those rail companies don't share routes. So often you only have one choice. And so one thing that the Surface Transportation Board can do is say, no, we're not going to approve this merger, and we're going to keep at least a modicum of competition in this industry. And furthermore, we're going to look into ways in which we, you know, could create even more competition, maybe break you guys up. And that will get the attention of the rail companies. I mean, Wall Street has controlled this industry for far too long. The term that gets used is precision scheduled railroading. And all that means is cut staff, cut capacity, cut everything to the bone, and consolidate so that you can charge the maximum amount of price because you're throttling the capacity yourself. And that's what this industry has been. And so we need to see more force on the regulatory side, in addition to better laws around the workers being able to collectively bargain.
I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with David Day, and he's the executive editor over at the American Prospect. Prospect.org is their website if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Incredible stuff. Now, again, you go back to this regulatory stuff. We just came out of 4 years of the Trump administration, you know, cutting regulations at every turn. And you've got this right-wing fantasy of, you know, job-killing regulations. We got to do away with them all. And this is an example of, you know, an industry that isn't overly regulated, because look at what they get away with. And what that trickle-down effect is, it's basically people who are living to work for that company out of fear that they're going to get fired. If they get sick, if their kids get sick, if they want to take a minute off, there are real problems here.
And they can only do that because they have no choice. You know, it's as much as the shippers have no choice for how they're going to get their goods to market. The workers have no choice. They don't have another rail company that they can jump to. They know that they have to abide by the terms of the rail barons, people like Warren Buffett, who owns BNSF Railroad, the largest one. They have to abide by those terms, or else they're going to have to look for other form of gainful employment. And what's really interesting here is if you listen to the shippers, which are in industries that do not like to be regulated, right? In their own industries, people like the American Chemistry Council or Big Ag or things, yep. They are screaming for regulation in the rail industry, right? I mean, it's not something you expect big business to say, that we need a stronger hand from government so that we can, you know, have a functioning commercial system in the U.S. But that's what they're saying. And that shows you how out of control the rail industry has become.
Now, again, you've brought up a couple of things. I mean, you know, for me, we need major comprehensive labor law reform across the entire board. But the railway, the RLA is right front and center as the one of the big ones. Again, you know, coming out of this pandemic, we see consolidation just jacking up prices. And I say causing the majority of the inflation that we're suffering from. And these railroads being part of that. How come we aren't hearing those stories? Tonight, everything is about Biden making this choice. All of the attacks right. are Democrats are weak on labor and he's not as pro-union. Right. How come we're not talking about these companies who are manipulating a system and they've got all the power and control? Why isn't that the message?
Well, I mean, sure, this is a new the media often has this this blind spot where they only look at what's new, right? What's new and what's now. And what's new is that the Congress and the president are going to force these workers back onto the job. But, you know, behind that is 40 years of an industry that has been really terrible for workers. Over the last 6 years, the rail industry has cut roughly 30% of its workforce.
Yeah.
So, you know, the ones that have remained may be going back to a job that's, you know, pretty crappy and that doesn't have weekends and that doesn't have sick days and things, but they have a job, and 30% of the workforce doesn't anymore. And that's entirely because of this Wall Street mentality of maximize your profits by cutting labor to the bone. And that's the core problem that we have to talk about here.
No, I spend a lot of time in the rail yards because it's part of my job. And you talk to these people, and these trains are getting longer. They're getting much more difficult to manage. And they want to go from, you know, a two-man crew down to a one-man crew eventually. And then eventually right. they want to get rid of workers altogether and automate the whole damn thing. You go, this message to the broader public, because strikes and in labor things like this are won and lost, I believe, on public opinion. I think the public opinion is on the side of the workers.
I agree. The problem is the law isn't.
So if there were a lot of wildcat strike, I mean, if these workers said, you know what, we don't care what you say, Congress, we're fighting for this. I know the unions would get slapped with huge fines and all the draconian stuff that would happen to the institutions. But what if the workers just said, you know what, we're done. We're not doing this anymore.
Well, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, certainly we've been down that road. It was before your time and before my time, and it was in, you know, Eugene Debs and the Pullman strike. And we saw what happened then. The National Guard came out and they started to run the railroads, right? So I don't know exactly what would happen if there was some sort of wildcat.
And I don't know that that's a bad thing, to be honest. You know, let the National Guard come in. At least there's some consequence for these railroad companies. At right. this point, there is none. Or am I just too?
The problem is, it's a lot to, as you know, it's a lot to ask of a worker to say that, you know, it's now on you to break the law, to risk prison, to risk everything that you have over this principle. And it may be the right thing to do, but it's easy for me, I guess. It feels like, to say, yeah, they should go out on a wildcat strike. I don't have to do it, right? It doesn't affect me in the kind of way that it would affect those workers. So I feel like it's a very personal decision for those workers to take that step.
But, you know, I do talk to some of these folks, and the anger is there that they feel that they have nothing. You know, the Republicans hate them because at every turn they're deregulating, they're passing laws to make things worse. And Democrats don't seem to be there willing to fight with and for them. You know, I've said a million times, in a street fight, Democrats will offer to hold your coat. This seems like that kind of a feeling.
It is a shame because, as you've said, this administration and this National Labor Relations Board has been a positive force for labor. I mean, just this week, I believe Amazon was found to have illegally fired workers. There are those kinds of injunctions that have been filed all the time with the Amazon worker movement, with the Starbucks worker movement, with we're seeing all this energy in labor, and some of the rulings that have been passed have really aided that in many ways. And yet, you know, it's kind of like when the rubber meets the road here, and the decision needs to be made. The path of least resistance is what's taken, and ultimately that sides with the bosses rather than the workers.
No, look, at the end of the day, Biden made the only choice he could make, because you made this point at the beginning, this pain and suffering for everybody else in the working class and people, you know, who need medicine and who need food and all the things that transportation brings. The railroad companies know this, and this is a game of chicken, and they're willing to allow the working class to suffer. The workers are trying to figure out, hey, how do we make our lives better? Because that's what unions are supposed to be doing, making lives better. But when the game's already rigged, this is where, again, I keep coming back to this. You know, I'm not going to beat Biden up too much because I think he's done a lot of good stuff. But in this, I don't know that I would have played this the same way.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the things that you say is that you want to get caught trying, right?
Yep.
In politics. He could have said nothing, or said, you know, I believe that the rail industry needs to give these workers the basic dignity they want. And then when he got the agreement, he could make a big, you know, when he got the bill from Congress that he would inevitably get, probably with a veto-proof majority, he could either say, you're going to have to do that, Congress, I'm not going to sign it, or say, reluctantly, they passed it with a veto-proof majority, I'll sign this, but here are my principles. Instead, he preempted the process by saying, yeah, we need this agreement. And, you know, the fact that he said, I'm a very pro-labor person, but in this case, you know, that I think rubbed people the wrong way.
No, me as well. I mean, I thought for sure there was going to be another cooling off period to get us on the other side of the Christmas holiday. And then this would have been a Republican, House that would have had to have done this, which they would have done gleefully. So let me ask you this, because, you know, I'm getting a lot of, see what Biden did. You know, Trump would have done something different. Would Trump have done anything different?
No, absolutely not. I mean, if anything, the force back to work would have come earlier, probably in advance of a presidential emergency board. They wouldn't have even had a board where they did get a 24% wage increase, I believe.
Yep.
Trump probably would have preempted that whole process and put him right back on the job. And, you know, I mean, we don't have to guess what a Republican administration, even a moderate Republican administration, would have done in the event of a strike that was looming. That's exactly what George H.W. Bush did. He signed the bill and forced everybody back to work. So this was inevitable. I think everybody knew it. And the workers said, look, I'm not going to sign an agreement that I don't want, the ones that held out. If this is going to be imposed on me, let Washington impose it on me. And that's ultimately what happened.
Yeah. Last question I've got for you, because, you know, in looking at it, I had someone who did say, you know, give Joe a chance. And look, I want to give Biden every bit of the benefit of every doubt, because I do think his heart is in the right place. Is there something possibly in the works through the back channels? I mean, do the railroads just know they have the power and there's nothing that anyone can do about it?
When I talked to folks at Atlas Air, which is obviously not a rail company, an airline company, but it's governed under the Railway Labor Act, what they said to me is that management routinely laughed at them because they knew they had the upper hand. They have no ability to use the one thing that gets management's attention, and that's the strike. They knew they can't use it. So it was clear that there was this December 8th deadline And it just wasn't enough time to hammer out an agreement as much as, you know, it's been worked on in the past. And so at that point, I don't think that there was any back channel. There was no attempt to, you know, make a better agreement, especially because, you know, there is a split here, right? I mean, 8 unions said yes to this, reluctantly, but they said yes. A little less than half of the workers said that they'd go along with this. The AFL has not put out a statement about this, by the way, because 8 of those unions are part of the federation. So it was a very difficult situation, as you said, and I don't think that Biden thought that there was a way to get anything done other than a congressional resolution.
Yeah,
and he didn't have to ask for it, but he did.
Yeah, no, it's just one of those moments. And look, I had a listener who reached out and said, "This is why we have to have a general strike." And I'm going, "I wish we were that country. I wish we were the culture that had that kind of solidarity. That yes, we would all take to the streets and we would all bear the consequences and we would all be willing to suffer what consequences would come out of it. But we're not that society." We're just not.
Yeah, it's true.
It's that simple. But David, I appreciate the time. Good stuff as always. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
All right, Rick. Thanks a lot.
Good stuff. Our good friend David Dayan. Make sure you check out the work that he does over at the American Prospect, prospect.org, the website. Going to take a quick break right back here from Atlanta, Georgia. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying, taking a beating today over the president's announcement and, of course, what the appearance is. The appearance is that these railroad workers are going to get tossed under the tracks. And, you know, look, that's what the optics are. And I'm hoping my next guest will help shed some light on what's actually going on and, what could come of this. That's why I've asked Greg Regan to come talk with us. Greg is the president of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Happy to be here.
So, look, the messaging today has been very clear. You know, the president didn't have these workers' backs. The messaging has been he's the most pro-union president in the history of the country. Share your thoughts with me.
Look, I think that the criticism of the president, well, I certainly... You know, I agree that it is always an unfortunate occurrence if the right to ratify your contract is taken away from rank and file workers. That is never an outcome that anybody wants. And certainly when the unions who were at the bargaining table started this process 3 years ago, that was never their intention. The other thing I will say is that it's been 3 years of negotiating. If not for the president's actions over the summer, we in all likelihood would still be in mediation with the railroads where they are refusing to negotiate in good faith. And in what the president helped do over this summer and over the fall is through this presidential emergency board, get a much, much better deal and move the railroads to a much different perspective than where they were at the beginning of this year. And I think that while clearly there was a major omission on sick leave, that was something that I wish the presidential emergency board had addressed. They did not. But I think it would be a mistake not to look at some of the other aspects here as well. And the reasons why, frankly, 8 out of the 12 unions did ratify this contract. It's the largest wage increase in 45 years. The impacts, you know, the workers are not going to pay a penny more at the doctor or at the pharmacy. There was an increase in travel disbursements for BMWE members, for maintenance workers. There was an additional $5,000 bonus for every single employee. And there are a lot of things here that are attractive, that are good. And if you look at the operating crafts, they, through the long negotiating process in September, that 20-hour session, they got a major concession on one of the attendance policy issues. That again is what allowed them to sign a tentative agreement and get it ratified in the with the engineers. So yes, sick leave was a major omission. This is something we should fight for as a principle in the labor movement. That's why we supported the amendment that passed in the House, and why we will hope that the Senate votes on it. And frankly, it'll show everybody pretty clearly who is on the worker side and who is not. Because I don't think we're getting 10 Republican senators. They're going to be the ones to block this thing.
Yeah, no, this is the fear in this, that the thing that forces the workers with this contract, and you've said there's a lot of good stuff in it, and there is, but the main part of it is the engineers still don't have sick time. They still don't get to spend a day with their family. They still have to be on call all the time. All of these conditions are still there. And, you know, we in the labor movement believe in, you know, you work so that you can afford a lifestyle. You don't live to work, you work to live. And it sounds like these guys, you know, and again, the framing, and for me, it's the optics that I'm hearing from people and that we're seeing. The framing is that they're throwing these folks under the bus.
Yeah. And I understand that. I do. And trust me, I'm angry about how this is coming to a close at the moment. But I also want to say that the anger needs to be directed, not necessarily at the president. It needs to be directed at the railroads. The problems in the industry, that there are some really fundamental problems in the industry right now that, to be honest, cannot be fixed in a collective bargaining agreement. If you look at why there is such a focus on these quality of life issues, if you're looking at the reason why the railroads even put in place some of these attendance policies, the reasons why we're asking for sick leave because workers cannot get access to the leave that they are granted under this agreement because the railroads continue to reject it. And at the core of all of these quality of life issues goes back to one thing. It's that the railroads furloughed 45,000 workers over the last 7 years, and they're increasingly demanding that their workforce do a heck of a lot more with a heck of a lot less and fewer people. Until we can start to right that ship and actually have a workforce that can meet the needs, the service needs of the country, and have a size of a workforce that can allow people some flexibility and redundancy, until that issue gets solved, none of these issues are going away. No. So that's why, you know, I would view this, and I think that all of this anger, which is entirely justified and entirely legitimate, we need to channel that as a labor movement, as working people, we need to channel that into a sustained campaign to reform this industry once and for all. We cannot allow to continue to go the direction we've been going here. We need to make sure that we channel all of this anger, and whether it be through, you know, getting regulations or executive action out of the president, whether it be pushing legislation in the House and the Senate, or whether it be just good old fashioned public shaming, you know, that's where we need to be channeling our energy to hopefully get these guys to wake up and stop treating their workers like dirt.
No, I mean, this is an industry that's wildly profitable. I mean, what was it? $23 billion profit last year, $22.1 billion in the first three quarters. So they'll top last year's profits. The fact that see, here's my problem. Most of the time employers say, hey, we can't afford to do this because of financial constraints. The railroad is simply saying, no, we don't want to. We could easily afford it with a mere fraction of the profit that your labor creates. We just choose not to. That's my problem in this. And my problem is the law then says, well, you know, we're afraid of the rest of the economy having to suffer. And the railroads know this.
Yep.
And they abuse this. And well, it seems the politicians, and this was the frame of the, and I know this sounds like I'm beating a dead horse, but the frame is, and this is where, again, I hope you're right. We can channel this in the right direction and channel this to the right anger. You know, it just seems like, you know, corporate America gets whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want. And we working stiffs, we're the ones who get it on the chin.
Yeah. Look, I agree with you. And I think, you know, one of the things that really, you know, because I don't know if you saw Marco Rubio's tweet from yesterday.
I did.
He's like, I'm going to stand with the workers against the union bosses and the president, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, Senator, I don't recall you ever co-sponsoring any of the pro-worker legislation that we pushed out there. I don't remember you voting for the infrastructure law. I don't remember you talking about sick leave in any other time. But guess what? If he's all of a sudden found Jesus on supporting working people, I guarantee you we're going to give him plenty of opportunities to prove it. in the next coming weeks and months. We're going to be pushing aggressively, because one of the issues that I think we've had, and one of the problems why this seems, I know I've talked to reporters, I've talked to other people in Congress, where they feel like this all seems so sudden, and it's not sudden. We've been talking about these issues, the problems with precision scheduled railroading and staffing levels and furloughs. We've been talking about that for years now. And what we cannot allow to have happen is to go back to being the sort of anonymous economic giant. You know, the workers who are such a vital role in our economy, so vital that Congress would not allow them to go on strike for fear of what it would do to our economy. Well, let's not go back to just being sort of under the radar. We have to make sure we're making that members of Congress and and regulators and the media, that they don't just pay attention to rail workers and what rail workers are doing, either when there's a possible strike or when there's a fatality on the railroad tracks. We need to be making this a constant effort to educate people about what people are facing every single day. And I think that's the only way we're going to start to address some of the fundamental rot in the industry that we see right now.
No, you're absolutely spot on, right? But, especially on the part that this isn't new. Now, we've been talking about the issues on the railroad for a couple of years, and for years before that. Because, look, I keep saying they're trying to make this industry so unworkable, unlivable, that eventually they get to automate the whole damn thing. Because they went down to a two-man crew. Now they want a one-man crew. You've got all this stuff because it's all about the bottom line and the more profit. $23 billion pure profit, that's not enough for these giant railroads. And I keep going, this was a moment for Democrats, Greg. I believe this was a moment for them to put up. This was the moment to go, you know what? Maybe we need to start looking at breaking some of these behemoths up. Maybe we need to have some competition in the rail industry. Maybe we need to start doing things, I don't know, a little bit differently.
Well, I think that and you know what? I think if there has been a positive to come out of this whole process here, I can assure you that from the White House, at every level of the White House, they got a firsthand look at how craven the railroads are. They were there when during the bargaining, they saw how dug in they were on some of these issues. They saw how disrespectful they were to the unions in terms of bargaining, and frankly, dismissive of a lot of our concerns. And members of Congress are paying attention to this stuff now. So I think we will have opportunities to start to hold these guys more accountable.
Do you think so? I mean, because I got to tell you, Greg, they don't seem unique to me. This seems like what corporate America has been getting away with for a very long time. It's just now that the economy was on the brink. Because look, I agree. Had they gone on strike, it was going to hurt. People were going to be affected. It was going to stop the supply of goods. It was going to be painful. But again, corporate America wins in this game of chicken because we're not willing to fight and we're not willing to take them on.
I can assure you that if you had one of the railroad CEOs on here right now, they would not feel like they won. I can assure you, they feel like they got completely dominated in that PEB recommendation. They feel like they gave up an arm and a leg, which is ridiculous. I agree with that. I think they're delusional if they think that they are somehow, getting put to the poorhouse because they have to pay people a better wage here, especially during a time of inflation like this. But, they feel like they lost. They do. And I think that's a testament to how hard people fought at the table to get the best deal they could out of this. And, the fact that it is the largest raise in 45 years reflects the fact that we had a lot of really strong arguments on our side, and I think won on a lot of this stuff. It doesn't mean that it's perfect. There was, again, the sick leave was a major omission from the PEB. But let me also point out that, once those contracts failed, when BMWE and the boilermakers and the railroad signalmen, when their contracts failed, the first thing they did is they went back to the railroads and said, hey, our members spoke loud and clear. Sick leave is a major issue. Give us, if we can talk about a sick leave policy, I think we can ratify this. I think that our workers will do it. And the railroads just flat out refused. They said the water is all out of the well. And they had, unfortunately, because of the realities of the law, they didn't have a huge incentive to try to move. And I'm not sure that maybe I'm wrong. I'm not sure that even a strike necessarily would have moved them either. I think they'd be perfectly happy to watch the world burn if it meant they didn't have to give up anything in the short term. That's where we have to make sure. And I think that's where it's important moving forward, because we're going to be back at the table now. The union's going to be back at the table in like 2 years. for the next round. But we shouldn't, we can't put ourselves in a corner where the only opportunity to try to address some of these fundamental issues are through the CBAs. Let's be clear. We have to be able to try to use everything at our disposal to actually reform this industry, as I've said.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll point out too, and this is where, you know, I get nervous because of the fact that Congress has the ability to act in the way that they are now. You know, guess what happens in a month? The House of Representatives is, you know, we're going to have potentially, if he can pull it off, Speaker McCarthy. And I guarantee you, you know, they'd be looking to extract a pound of flesh from the unions on something like this. That's where you start gambling with the fact that maybe they say, you know, that 24% compounded raise, that's too high. Why don't we just notch that down to 18%? Something like, I mean, those are very much potential outcomes if the national environment changes. And obviously we're going to lose a chamber. You know, the Democrats are no longer going to control the House.
Yeah, no, I kept hearing today, Greg, that, you know, if Donald Trump were president, this wouldn't be happening. And there's part of me that agrees that if Trump were president, none of this would be happening. They probably still wouldn't have a contract. They'd probably still be stalemate, and nothing would be happening. And you wouldn't have gotten all of the things that you had talked about. But I'm curious, do you think things would have been different under the last administration?
I think they'd still be in mediation right now. I think we'd be looking at year four without a raise for these workers. I think we'd be no further along than where we were to begin with. And if for whatever reason the board did find a Republican controlled board did find a reason to, you know, release the workers and start this PEB process and everything, I guarantee you the people who were on that board would have been a heck of a lot less friendly than the ones that we had. You know, we had, you know, two of the people were our recommended, our best picks. And I think it showed in sort of how we won on things like healthcare and wages and, you know, the bonuses and the, you know, some of the other issues at the table itself.
So last question I've got for you, because, you know, as I'm looking at this and how we move this forward, messaging wise, especially, because again, you know, I think Biden's heart and head is in the right spot. The optics are just bad.
Yeah.
And how do we use this moving forward to bring people together instead of the way it's being used right now? Because as you pointed out, you know, Marco Rubio's out there. I'm the champion for working people. You got a bunch of Republicans who voted against the bill to force this contract on them. Now, granted, not many of them voted for the sick days, which is very interesting and telling when you look at both of the votes. The first vote being, you know, you're going to take this contract and not strike. And the other one going, no, we're going to give you the 7 days sick time. Very interesting that the Republicans didn't take that part of it on. But, you know, how do we use this forward? How do we take that and use this in a way to, as you said, channel that anger?
Well, first of all, I think the one thing that having these sort of parallel votes, one thing that does, it shows pretty clearly, puts people on the record about what they actually believe in here. And you're right. We had three Republicans vote for this thing out of nearly 200. You know, that's for the sick leave issue. That's pretty astounding. It shows you right there, sort of, you know, where the parties in general are going to stand on the issues that are most important to us. And I think it will be true in the Senate as well. What we need to look at here, and I think, you know, part of this is obviously there's going to be regulations coming out. There's the Biden Federal Railroad Administration is doing a two-person crew rule that will be, I mean, I'll be testifying there in December, and that should be done really soon. The other areas we need to look at are how all of these things, whether it be attendance policies and the work sizes, how they affect safety. The fact that if people don't have access to sick leave, that becomes a safety problem. If people are tired and being overworked, that becomes a major safety problem for 3 mile long trains carrying hazardous materials through every community in this country. So we're going to look at ways that we can start addressing these problems in a much more proactive way on those issues. And then, you know, looking forward, I think there's going to have to be a lot of opportunities at legislation where we do make this to be very clear that there is a threat to the safety of communities around this country unless we start seeing some changes in the industry to make it better functioning, and that they actually have workers who have the support, rest, and policies they need. So that is something that we're going to continue to fight on here. And like I said, it can't just be sort of wait and quietly behind the scenes or get things. I mean, we're pretty good at trying to do stuff behind the scenes, but it's clear that that's not that that can't be the only way here. We're going to have to do things very publicly. We're going to have to get members of Congress directly engaged, you know, actively working with the administration to try to do some of this stuff. We're going to have to get legislation out there. You know, we're going to have to do a lot of things here and give members the opportunity to weigh in directly with their representatives as well. And try to hold people accountable, yeah. Not only, you know, in real time, but also we're going to have to remember this at the ballot box as well about who is actually standing with us here.
It is that to me that simple, and using this anger, as you pointed out, to channel it in a positive direction and come out of this stronger on the other side. But Greg, I appreciate the time as always. Good stuff.
All right. Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend, Greg Regan, head of the Transportation Trades Department there of the AFL-CIO. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1854. That was the day that Mary McDowell, known as the Angel of the Chicago Stockyards, was born. Mary's father brought the family to Chicago from Cincinnati after the Civil War. Her family was friends with U.S. President Rutherford B. Hayes, and as a young woman, she spent a month in the White House as a guest. Mary received her college degree and worked as a teacher for a wealthy family in New York. But living and working among the wealthy was not to be the course of her life. She returned to Chicago and became a kindergarten teacher at the famed Hull House. She then became the head of the University of Chicago Settlement House in the back of the yards. The Settlement House served the diverse neighborhoods around the Chicago stockyards. The community center included a library, play lots, gymnasiums, and classrooms. Mary and her Settlement House supported the rights of workers to form unions and to have safe working conditions. In 1903, Mary became the head of the Illinois chapter of the National Women's Trade Union League. The Pittsburgh Press reported on an incident that captured the spirit of Mary McDowell. The city of Chicago had a practice of using garbage to fill holes in the streets surrounding the stockyard. Mary showed up at the mayor's office with a group of women from the neighborhood and demanded, quote, "All right, we want the rest of it dumped on Lakeshore Drive. If it's good enough for the stockyards, it's good enough for the drive, too." As a result, the city stopped using garbage to repair the streets.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So what's interesting about this whole situation with Biden and the railroads and the Republicans now finding, it's amazing to me, you know, when there's something that can make Biden look bad, Republicans are all in favor of it, even if it's something that's completely out of character. You know, Marco Rubio tweeted out today, the railways and workers should go back and negotiate a deal that the workers, not just union bosses, will accept. But if Congress is forced to do it, I will not vote to impose a deal that doesn't have the support of the rail workers. He's now the champion? When did this happen? Now, understand, I've been telling you this for a while. Republicans are trying to find that way to pivot to where they look like they're friendly to working people, that pivot to make them, no, we're the people who believe in the working class, just not those unions. Not just workers collectively organizing to come together to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and yes, sick time. Where's Marco, I don't know, with that whole situation going on down in In Alabama, where those workers at Warrior Met Coal have been on strike for, well, over a year. Where's little Marco saying, hey, get back to the table? Where's Marco saying, hey, Warrior Met Coal making your billions. Get back to the table. Treat those deals. Where is he? Oh, that's right. Nowhere. Because this, and again, it comes back to the politics, the optics. This is going to be a black eye for Biden. It is. And look, he had to make this choice. There was no alternative. And I know everyone's like, no, he should let him. They should let. No, he was never. It was never going to happen because it would have caused major chaos in our economy. And look, from a purely political standpoint, it's almost a murder-suicide pact. Now, what I would have done, and I would have done this much differently, I would have come forth and said, look, can't have a strike, but we're going to impose those 4 sick days. We're going to pass this in this resolution, and there's going to be only one resolution, because understand, as much as I hate to say it, understand, that resolution that has the sick days in it, it's not going to pass. Republicans will make sure of that. Republicans will make sure that it does not pass and that they do not get the sick time that they need, that they've earned. Again, our party of family values, they know how to play politics. Oh boy, do they. Oh boy. But when it comes to actually making workers' lives better, they don't care. Because ultimately, Republicans hate working people.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So another one of these polls that I always find interesting. Another one of these, we spent a little bit of money researching a topic that I think is common sense on so many levels. But I look at our friends over at the Policy Matters Ohio group who have come out and said, shockingly, that the folks in Ohio support raising the minimum wage and increasing taxes on the wealthy and corporations. And here's one of the things, and the reason I bring this up is, you know, this is universally one of those places that there's agreement. As we were out today, and as we've been out the last couple of days here in Atlanta, talking with union members, talking with voters about, you know, this election, which is really extraordinarily important, we're not changing hearts and minds. Understand, at this point, there are no undecideds. You know, I've yet to find somebody go, gee, you know, I haven't really thought about this campaign that much. I haven't thought about this election that much. I haven't really thought about who I'm going to support. No, I haven't met that. Everybody that we've met thus far, they know who they're voting for. Right now, this is just about getting people motivated to go and vote. This is a get out the vote operation. It's not about educating. It's not about hearts and minds, but it does bring up some really good conversations. And one of them, the economy, which as a working person, as someone who does a working class radio program, as someone who believes that if you work hard, you play by the rules, you should get ahead. This is one of these little polls that you go, duh, universally, people should be in favor of this. And it's a topic that I bring up, this idea of having a tax code where the wealthy do pay higher taxes. And what's interesting is very few people get that. Here's what's troubling. We went through the 2010 era, the Tea Party groups. We're taxed enough already. And for those who don't know what T stands for, that was it. We're taxed enough already. You know, we're the most overtaxed people in the history of humanity. You know, we're overburdened with taxation. Reality. And again, I look at my people who bought the red hats. Every time I ask, so when was America last great that we're going to make it great again? And they generally point to the fabulous 50s. And I have to bring up the fact that back then, the taxes on working people were higher. And the taxes on the very wealthy were really, really higher. In fact, the top marginal tax rate back in 1953, the Eisenhower years, the good socialist Eisenhower, 92%. Our rich folks were paying more than double, almost triple what they're paying now as a tax rate. And look, patriotic. We're paying for our wars. We're investing in infrastructure. We're taking care of our workers. This is one of those things, those frames that keep coming up in my view. And I think it's important because this could be, I keep figuring out how do we get away from the red hat, blue hat? How do we put down that frame? How do we find the middle of the road and go, okay, these are things we can agree on. Taxing the wealthy, we can agree on. Wasn't always that way. Republicans used to be staunchly anti-tax. No, no one should ever pay taxes. Taxes are bad. I'm now finding kind of a crack in that. In talking with these, you know, conservative union members, talking with these, you know, these folks who in the past had towed the party line. Lower taxes. Lower taxes. Lower taxes. In fact, you know, I had an interesting conversation with a gentleman today who pointed to Trump as someone who said, well, Trump was right. We need to fix the tax code. And I said, you do know that he did fix the tax code, right? And he's like, what do you mean? I go, the only legislation that they actually passed was a tax bill, remember? It was a massive tax cut. Not for you, but for the wealthy, for corporations. We gave a massive tax break. And what we put it on? We put it on the credit card. We put it on your children's bill. And he was like, no, they didn't do that. Yeah, it's the only accomplishment. It's the only thing that they actually got through and signed and did all that really with. And it made the tax situation worse. And again, I come back to this moment where this guy wants to go back to a higher tax rate on the very wealthy. He wants to go back into a higher tax rate on corporations because, look, we understood. We understood. Need money for roads and bridges. Need money for military. Need money to take care of veterans who are homeless and hungry and disabled. And we need to take care of children who are hungry and homeless. There's so many things we need to be doing. And the benevolence of our very wealthy, not cutting it. So, again, I come back to this moment. Okay, we're never going to agree on the abortion issue. You're just not. There's no common ground in my view. You either are pro-safety or you are not. And look, we ran into a bunch of people who, you know, this was their issue, their main issue. And you're not going to convince them, so I don't even try. But on the economic part, this is where the working class can focus. This is where we channel some of the anger. Minimum wage. I've yet to find a working person who is adamantly opposed to someone earning a decent minimum wage. Now, you get people go, well, you know, minimum wage is only for teenagers and for people who don't have skills like me. And you go, but at the end of the day, you still have to pay your bills. That whole work hard, play by the rules, get ahead thing. So, overall, the reality is, yeah, the folks over at Policy Matters Ohio, they're right. Raising the minimum wage is popular. Taxing the very wealthy, very popular. Why don't we do it? Well, because, well, the very wealthy and corporations own our government. And you don't have to look any farther than what happened with this rail situation. You know, Biden's taking the arrows. And there's part of me that goes, this is what a leader does. There's part of me that, and look, I'm angry, like a lot of workers are, but I'm angry at the whole situation. I think Biden could have handled it better, but understand, he's the buck stops here guy. He came out, he made a statement, he's taken responsibility for it, he's taken it on. Everyone knows there was never going to be a strike. They were never going to allow that to happen because of how disruptive it would have been to everything that this country has and does, and really we would undo the progress we've done to this point. And Republicans were, oh boy, tizzy, going, oh, please do that so we can pin this on Biden. We can attack him over this. And I go back to, again, the Rubios of the world, the Josh Hollies of the world, these Republicans who are now going, oh, hey, we support the workers. Yet there hasn't been a pro-worker bill that's been proposed in the last 20 years that one of them have supported. There's nothing that they have put forth that would benefit working people. Nothing. Because I'll renew the call again. Let me do this one more time. Show me one piece of legislation that a Republican has proposed that was going to help a working person. Solely help a working person. No sweeteners for corporate America. No handouts for the very wealthy. No pork belly spending for the well-to-do just to get a modest increase in the minimum wage or something. Can't do it. Can't do it. And this is where the frustration comes in, because I see the messaging coming out of this and Republicans using this as an opportunity to say, see, we care about working people. We don't hate working people, like Rick Smith says over there at the Rick Smith Show. No, we like you. It's those union bosses. And I always love hearing people try to divorce unions from their members. Well, these union bosses are making you do this. Unions are workplace in the democracy, in the work, democracy in the workplace. This is where active, engaged members, and I hope every person is, has a say in all of this. And look, you know, 8 of the 12 rail unions approved their contracts and got really pretty decent raises, got pretty decent contracts out of it, much better than they would have gotten without the emergency board, without the presidential emergency board, much better. But you know, I believe in a movement of an injury to one being an injury to all. So if you've got engineers who aren't getting sick days, you've got engineers who are not getting the things that they need, then the movement, and this is where the rail union's good on them, said if one union strikes, we all go. But the rail companies, and this is where I want to come back to, because this is the frustrating part of this, and this is the part that did not come up any time today in talking with people. It was all about Biden. This is all Biden's fault. Biden did this. It's these rail companies. It's 40 years of supply side voodoo Reaganomics. It's 40 years of the big fish eating the little fish. It's 40 years of mass consolidation. It's 40 years of one company eating another. And at some point, for longtime listeners, you've heard me say this 1,000 times, and I'll say it 1,000 times more in the future, so get used to it. I want to know who today's Teddy Roosevelt is going to be. Who's today's TR? Who's going to be the trust buster? Who's going to be the one that breaks up the monopolies? Who's going to be the one that says, this is too far? This situation is too far. When you look at the fact that this industry is as wildly profitable as it is. Oh my gosh, profitable. $23 billion with a B. $23 billion profit last year. $22.1 billion this year. Profit. That's above and beyond everything that they've paid out. Now understand, to get the four sick days that they were asking for, it's like $160 million or something like that. $180 million, something like that. You're million compared to billion. You're missing 3 more zeros. We're talking a very small amount, less than 1% of their profit. Now Congress is going to go forth, and the House passed a bill with 7 days, sick days in this. It's never going to pass the Senate. I'm telling you this right now. It's not going to happen. There are not 10 Republicans who are going to step forth and go, yep, I'm going to vote for it. Maybe little Marco, just so he can say, hey, look at me, I care. I doubt it, though. Highly doubt it. In fact, I'm not a gambling man, but I would probably bet my last dollar he's a no vote. But we find out that, you know, guaranteeing seven sick days, let's say the seven sick days that Hickenlooper threw out that they voted on today, that would cost about $321 million a year. Million, not billion, million. About a little less than 2% of the profits that these companies are making. Small amount. 15 days of sick leave, which nobody was really asking for, would cost the industry, you know, what, 3/4 of one of those billions, of which they had last year 23 of those billions. But nope, can't afford it. Sorry, can't do it. And the reality is they can. They just refuse. And they've come straight out and said, we're not going to do it. We don't have to. And this is the message that I've been thinking about all day. Because as I'm talking to working people, the anger is being, this is the latest outrage candy. And look, I'm angry. But I'm angry at I see the elephant. I'm not just seeing the elephant's behind. And the whole elephant is, we've got an industry that's been not well regulated. We've got an industry that's been allowed to consolidate and consolidate and consolidate, slash workers, abuse their workforce without any accountability. Because they know at the end of the day, there's a backstop. The workers can only demand so much. They can only stand up and speak out so much. They can only do so much because they don't have the right to strike. Now, do I want them to go on strike? No. But that threat, that arrow in the quiver, that bullet in the chamber, if you want to use that analogy for my gun friends, just having that, you know, Barney Fife having the bullet in his pocket, having it just in your pocket is something of a consequence. But to be completely neutered and unable to say, you know, what every worker can do, fold their arms and march their feet. Because it's the only true power that working people have. When that's taken away, well, we're screwed. And for me, right now, the messaging, and I'm hoping unions pick this up, the messaging is on their side. The messaging is on the side of the workers in fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities for their workforce to, oh, I don't know, spend time with their kids. Sounds like something we should, I don't know, just kind of a weird thought, we should support. And not just for rail workers. And this is where you go, we got to go big. Every worker, every person should have the ability, if they're sick, to stay home. If their kids are sick, to stay home with them. Take a day off without losing pay. Too many people don't have that option. And look, the unions, they say, look, we make lives better. Except for our railroad workers. Is that the message? Well, it's the message that the rail barons want us to think about. Because here's the reality. There would have been no threat of strike had there been sick days. It's not that hard to figure out. Ain't that difficult, folks. Ain't that difficult at all. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Love to hear it. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you find your favorites. You will find ours from Stitcher to Podbean, iHeart, iTunes, all of those places and everywhere in between. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the day the British House of Lords rejected the People's Budget. The proposed budget plan was a product of the Liberal government headed by Prime Minister H.H. Asquith. This budget was championed by the Chancellor of Exchequer, David Lloyd George, and the President of the Board of Trade, a young Winston Churchill. The goal of the budget was to shift more of the tax burden to the wealthy. Lloyd George introduced the budget to Parliament. He praised the budget, declaring, "This is a war budget. It is for raising money to wage implacable warfare against poverty and squalidness." The budget included tax increases for higher incomes to fund welfare reforms. The budget also called for a rise in the inheritance tax. These increases were relatively modest. The most controversial aspect of the people's budget was a hike on taxes on land sales. This would have had an impact on large landowners. Since many conservatives were large landowners, they opposed the budget. The House of Lords was allowed to reject the budget but could not amend a money bill. They had not rejected a budget for more than two centuries. King Edward VII privately urged that the budget be passed to avoid a crisis. The public clamored for the passage of the budget plan, but the House of Lords vetoed it. The House of Lords eventually capitulated and passed the budget the following April. Resistance to a progressive income tax structure and raising the tax rates on the wealthy is not unique to the British Parliament. Similar tax proposals have been offered in the United States and have been met with stiff opposition from conservatives in our Congress. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So this didn't take long. Didn't take long at all. Donald Trump's tax returns have finally been received by the House Ways and Means Committee. You may remember, not too long ago, the Supreme Court denied the last best hope Trump had to continue to hold them away from public view. But it now, the House Ways and Means Committee now has 6 years of Donald Trump's federal tax returns, ending what has been a year-long court battle. And look, this has been 2015 to this point. You go, hold on, let me think about this for a second. They have 6 years of his tax returns. I want to know what 6 years. Was it the 6 years prior to 2015? You know, the ones that he promised he was going to release. Remember that? Yeah. Here's another interesting little tidbit. Media didn't spend a lot of time on this, but the Oath Keeper guy, guilty. Stuart Rhodes and this Kelly Meggs, Oath Keepers, guilty. And what were they guilty of? Conspiracy. Conspiracy to overthrow our government. Guilty of seditious conspiracy. Guilty. And you go, but what's that mean? It means there was a conspiracy to overthrow our government. Mm-hmm. There was. And you go, but these are just two people. Yeah, two people with ties to Donald Trump. Through Roger Stone, Michael Flynn, Ali Alexander, the 2020 campaign. Yeah, there was that. And this is where you go, we have to hurry and get the details and the facts. And this is where I'm hoping the January 6th Commission, they come out with their findings very soon. Because we all know that once Republicans take over, they're going to quash all of this. They're going to hide all of it because it doesn't make them look good. And this is one of those things that, I want truth. I don't want conspiracy around every corner. I want truth. I want honesty on both sides of the aisle. Bizarre times we live in. Now, something I said a while ago that someone hushed me over. I said that I'd like to see Tim Ryan as the DCCC head. I'd like to see him head of the DNC. I'd like him to do something. Well, it's being floated now, evidently. He's being considered as the House Democratic Campaign Committee chair in the next cycle. Now, I find that interesting since, the Dems didn't really help him in Ohio. It is what it is. Also, I want to get to this real quick. Numbers are finally coming in that are saying that the share of the electorate for black voters was way down, plunged in this midterm. In fact, the lowest level since 2006. And you know, they pointed specifically to Georgia and North Carolina, which, you know, I thought both of those states were possible pickups for Democrats, but you had this. And this was one of those things that I had feared, that there wasn't the kind of enthusiasm, that there wasn't the kind of motivation for folks to come out and vote. And not seeing that here in Georgia now. You know, talking to people, the lines are long in places where there have never been lines, which means people are getting out to vote. They've had record turnout days. This is kind of a big deal. And the hope is when you have a higher turnout, Democrats do well. When working people come out to vote, when they find time off, working class candidates do better. It's that simple. I don't know that it gets any more difficult than that. But we've got a lot of work to do. I want to finish with Madison Cawthorn. Yes, Madison Cawthorn gave a speech on the House floor today where he said that our young men are taught that weakness is strength, that delicacy is desirable, and that being a soft metrosexual is more valuable than training in the mind, body, and soul. Social media has weakened us, he said, siphoned our men of their will to fight, to rise in a noble manner, and to square their jaws and charge once more into the breach line to defend the way they love. And I'm going, wait a second. Is this like one of those coming out kind of things? Because I got to tell you, Madison Cawthorn, not going to surprise me if the closet door swings open. Would not be surprising at all. And in fact, I hope he finds his peace. Because wow, he says, you know, will you reclaim your masculinity? Will you become a man? Interesting question, Madison. Will you? Sad, sad stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you miss any of the program, grab the podcast. Appreciate you being here. Looking forward to being back here next time. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.